Hi, I'm Dave Reinersman. Welcome to The Marvels of Science, a new podcast about the science and tech of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. All your favorite heroes and villains from Thor and Loki to the Wasp and Ant-Man. Speaking of the little guy, today's topic is Ant-Man and his incredible shrinking tech. Here with me to talk about the physics behind the tech is our science expert today, Daniel Whiteson, co-author of We Have No Idea, co-podcaster of Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe, professor of physics and astronomy at UC Irvine, and particle physicist at the Large Hadron Collider. Welcome to the podcast, Daniel.
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm excited to be here and talk about the tiniest stuff in the universe.
That's great, and I'm very thankful that you're on the show. I really appreciate it. And our color commentator is star of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Rick Moranis. No, sorry. That's not right. It's actually my favorite guest so far, ladies and gentlemen, my sister, Liesl Reinersman. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Liesl.
You're welcome.
I was very proud of myself when I thought of that joke.
Yeah, very nice. My introduction, much shorter than Daniel's. And my sister.
Your resume is somewhat less relevant to... Yeah. Quantum physics.
Preschool teacher? No.
Last episode, we talked about Ant-Man's ants, but today we're talking about his other power. He gets really, really small, which is not so impressive a way to phrase that.
Hey, little guy.
He and his partner, the Wasp, can hit a button on their suits and shrink to the size of, well, an ant. They can go way, way smaller than that too, but that's a whole different realm. So we're going to start with ant size first. We'll get to the crazy stuff later on. First question goes to Liesl. Let's say you have Ant-Man or the Wasp's suit. What changes in your life?
I wish I had a suit. I would even like a suit with like minimal powers, you know? Or maybe even just a suit with no powers.
Oh my gosh, what a question. realistically, probably not very much because I'm pretty lazy. Like, how much would I actually use it? Is it one of those things you'd be like, oh my God, I totally use that, and then it sits in your closet?
You just feel guilty about it. It's another thing to feel guilty about.
What could I be doing with this? And then I just sit there thinking about what I could do.
I often wonder about how much farther everything becomes if you're very tiny. Like, crossing the room is now like a football field. So in one way, it makes a lot of things harder.
Makes dieting easier, though. You can eat very small meals.
But I could get really big. Then, like, if I'm coming to visit you, I could, like, how big could I? Maybe I just walk there.
They manage this incredible feat using PIM particles, invented by Hank Pym, naturally. It seems pretty, gauche to name your discovery after yourself. Daniel, as far as I'm aware, the only particle named after a person is the Higgs boson. Did Peter Higgs name it after himself, do you know, or was it named by somebody else?
He did not name it after himself, actually, and there were like 7 or 8 people who came up with the same idea around the same time, and he got it named after him because of a paper later which referenced it. And so it was like the author of a subsequent paper basically named it after Higgs. But Higgs himself, he uses all 8 names when he talks about it.
Really? That's nice.
He's fairly modest, yeah. But there actually is another particle named after an individual. It's a particle at the center of like a crazy dispute in the history of particle physics. This one particle was found simultaneously by 2 different groups, one at Brookhaven and one at Stanford. And they each gave it their own name. And the group at Brookhaven, which was led by Sam Ting, an MIT professor, he named it the J particle because the letter J sort of looks like his name in Chinese. So he sort of named it after himself. And the Stanford group called it the Psi particle, like the Greek letter. And to this day, we call it the J Psi particle because we didn't want to get in the middle of that dispute.
That's just, we're not going to take a position on it. We're going to use both names.
Exactly. It's sort of the parental approach, you know, like, I don't want to hear about it. You two figure it out yourselves.
Following up on that, Liesl, as Reinersmans, do you think we get a little shortchanged? I'm thinking like the Reinersman process or the Reinersman constant would just be such a mouthful. Nobody would use it.
Well, I don't know. I took biology last semester and chemistry this semester, and they don't really seem to have a problem with that. There's a lot of stuff I was like having to remember, like Ozakazi fragments, or I think we could throw our whole last name in there. We could make everyone learn how to spell Reinersman.
It's been a very long frustration, at least a little doubly so.
Right. You get David.
Yeah.
No one's like, what? What did you, is that a name?
I get Steve and Daniel all the time. In school, I sat next to Daniel Riley, and I thought that's why people call me Daniel all the time. And then, you know, I left high school, and it still happened.
You know, I think there's some weird cognitive connection between Daniel and David, because I get called David Whiteson all the time. People just like assign those two names together in their minds.
Weird.
That's so weird.
So are you saying that your last name is the reason you haven't made a vast scientific discovery of great importance?
It's been holding me back. But Liesl is going into environmental science, so you have the opportunity, Liesl.
Well, now I have a new goal. Now I have a reason to do it.
Not just help save the Everglades or whatever. Speaking of names, Hank does call it a particle, but it looks like it's a liquid. And he also says it has a formula. So maybe we can give him the benefit of the doubt and say he's using the word particle in a more casual sense.
Well, surely the liquid contains particles.
But sort of everything contains particles, right?
Yeah.
So not really that insightful. I feel like they were using it back in the day when a particle was a new mysterious concept. And so they just sort of like stuck it in there as a mechanism for like new science weirdness. And another nit to pick on that is that you can't like invent a particle, right? You discover particles. You can't be like, I'm going to create a new kind of particle that doesn't exist in the universe. I mean, unless you're God or you're the master of the simulation or something, all you can do is discover them.
Regardless of what it is, here's what it does. Hank says that with it,
I created a formula that altered atomic relative distance.
Huh?
I learned how to change the distance between atoms. That's what powers the suit.
Daniel, my understanding of physics at these scales basically comes from you and Brian Cox. So I try to find the nuggets of truth in these things, but this is, I mean, is it just nonsense or is there something we can hang our hat on? Is there anything in the phrase reduce relative atomic distance that works in the real world?
No, there's something there. I mean, I don't have the hair of Brian Cox, but I can try to explain it. You know, you can think about it like this. Where does your size come from? Like, why are you as big as you are? If you drill down into what you're made out of, you're made of tiny little particles. Like an individual atom is tiny little protons and neutrons at the core surrounded by electrons. But the particles themselves have essentially no volume. So where does your volume come from? If you're just a pile of tiny particles, it comes from the forces that keep those things separated. So the reason, for example, you don't pass through the wall when you put your hand on it is that the forces from your electrons push against the other electrons. So it's the forces between atoms that are keeping you from collapsing into a pile of tiny little particles. So it really is the forces, the interatomic forces that create your appearance of volume and solidity. So if you imagine you could somehow like take a knob and tune that and change the strength of those forces so electrons like orbited closer to their atoms and you could squeeze the nuclei closer together, then you might effectively be able to shrink people.
Okay, we're already way further into plausibility than I thought we were gonna get.
I mean, whether you could do that without like changing fundamentally the laws of physics in the universe and whether the Pym particle is something that could accomplish that, I don't know. But there is an interesting concept there about how like the structures that we build really are controlled by fundamental parameters at the tiny level.
There's also, I think what that causes, though, is a problem with density that in the movie,
they treat him as if he has the strength of a full-grown man, but he's the size of an ant. So, for example, he can throw the punch of a normal person, even though he's super tiny.
Right, because he should have the same weight behind it. But sometimes he also lands on a record player and just slows it down rather than smashing it to pieces. Literally seconds after he fell onto a tile floor and cracked one of the tiles. So they play with it for comedic effects and for the plot. So, okay. Much of the drama of the movie comes because Hank is driven to keep this amazing discovery secret from the world until the bad guy, Darren Cross, manages to rediscover it. Daniel, are there any discoveries that were intentionally kept secret like this that you know of? I suppose, and then have since become public. If they were still secret, then we wouldn't know it. But does that ring any bells?
Well, you know, a lot of the technology behind nuclear weapons is still secret. We've discovered this stuff. We know how to shape nuclear materials to make the cores of nuclear bombs, but we certainly don't share that information with the general public for a good reason. And so there's a lot of this like heavily classified information, secrets about the nature of the nucleus that scientists have painstakingly and expensively revealed at, you know, vast public expense, which is now locked up behind closed doors. I grew up actually in Los Alamos, New Mexico, where a lot of that stuff happened.
I recall that your parents worked there. Is that right?
Yeah, both of my parents worked at the lab, and both of them were involved in weapons research. So I never actually got to visit their offices and know what they did. But I know that they essentially contributed to these programs. And that, you know, I think that has a real moral ambiguity behind it.
That fact about your parents was just in my head. You talked about that in your podcast, right? I don't recall stalking you on the internet, but I think you've talked about that.
That's plausible. Yeah, that's plausible. We'll go with that.
Let's say you did.
That sounds like a Marvel origin story to me.
You don't have any superpowers, right, Daniel?
Not that I can reveal here on the podcast, no.
That's also a secret.
And then, of course, there's the aliens at Area 51, where, you know, we've learned all about special anti-gravity stuff and technetium and stuff. But again, can't reveal that on the podcast.
And the Stargate program, of course.
The Stargate program.
I can't help it.
Yeah, you can't. Somehow, as I manage to work Star Trek into most conversations, Lisa manages to do it with Stargate.
But it's true. And I think it's a really interesting and important question. You know, like, what happens if you make a discovery about the nature of reality that then gives you some power over it and potentially could be weaponized and change the balance of power in the world? It's fascinating to think about the, like, real world consequences. And that's one reason why I went into particle physics, because I was pretty sure I would never figure out anything important.
I think I would maybe take issue with your implying particle physics isn't important there. I think particularly the people who are hoping to fund, you know, the next super collider would probably want you to not say that to too many people.
But, you know, it's important in the sense of, like, understanding the nature of the universe at a deep level, et cetera, not so much in, like, building a death ray.
Well, good. Although the rumors about when the LHC turned on, they're going to create a black hole that's going to suck the Earth into it, or they're going to, the 35 million different things people thought that the LHC was going to do.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a website you can check if you're ever worried about that. It's hasthelhcdestroyedtheworldyet.com. And we keep it up to date.
Fantastic.
Not a joke.
That's great. Hopefully one day, eventually, we can move the servers for that site off planet so that can actually update it. Okay, let's get weird with this now. Lisa, give a go at explaining the quantum realm according to Marvel.
Okay, according to Marvel, it's very pretty.
You never said it was so beautiful, Scott.
Tardigrades might eat you.
Make sure you stay out of the tardigrade fields. They're cute, but they'll eat you.
You can travel subatomically and move between the spaces of particles and get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and then travel through time.
Yeah, Scott shrinks down to get into somewhere really tiny. And in the first one, once he does, he beats the bad guy. Spoilers. He just keeps on shrinking. He has a regulator that apparently has brakes. It's like ABS. And he turns it off to beat the bad guy, but then can't stop shrinking. So he shrinks down past the scale of the nucleus of an atom into the quantum realm.
It means that you would enter a quantum realm.
What does that mean?
It means that you would enter a reality where all concepts of time and space become irrelevant as you shrink for all eternity.
In Ant-Man and the Wasp, the sequel, Hank goes down into the quantum realm to save his wife, Janet, who's been there for 30 years. We spend some more time there, and it looks more or less like a 70s blacklight poster. It looks amazing. Like, the special effects were amazing. Yeah. Daniel, if listeners would like to hear a more in-depth discussion about what a particle is, according to a particle physicist, I think you and Jorge have an episode about the Standard Model in general, right?
Mm-hmm. But spoiler, even particle physicists don't agree about what a particle is.
Awesome.
Not like that's our job or anything, but yeah.
Listeners will probably remember from school that atoms are made of protons and neutrons bound together tightly in the nucleus around which orbit electrons. What's wrong with that description, though?
Yeah, what's wrong with that description is that these particles are not just like tiny versions of baseballs and basketballs or even, you know, grains of sand. We'd like to imagine that they might be, because that's all we can do is think about what happens at the quantum realm in terms of things we're familiar with. The problem is that things in the quantum realm really are different from anything we've seen before. So specifically, for example, electrons don't move. They don't have paths and trajectories. If a particle is here and then it's there, you can't say necessarily it went from here to there. You could say it was here and then it was there, but particles don't have like paths. And so the whole concept of an orbit suggests that an electron, for example, always has a location, and then its next location is right next to its old location. All of these things are just assumptions we make about the world, because most of the stuff we're familiar with follows those assumptions. But deep down in the quantum realm, it's just not like that. Electrons have probabilities to be places. They don't necessarily have to actually have a defined location at any one point. So we don't think anymore about electrons moving in orbits around the nucleus the way planets move in orbits around the sun. We think of like a probability cloud of where the electron might be.
We call it a cloud because it's somewhere in this diffuse area and we can't nail it down. Is that the idea?
Yeah, well, you can think of that more specifically, like every point in space, the electron has a certain probability to be there. And some points are higher and some points are lower. And really far away from the atom, the probability goes to zero. And closer in, the probability gets higher. So the probability cloud is just like a phrase to try to generate in your mind a visual that's helpful in thinking about it. But really, the electron is somewhere around the core of the atom. We don't know exactly where. It has a probability to be here and a probability to be there. And the weird thing, of course, the super weird quantum thing is what happens when you ask, like, okay, where's the electron right now? Then for some reason, the universe collapses all that probabilities and gives you one value and says, oh, it's here right now. Then later on, it can be somewhere else. And so it can do really weird things like quantum tunneling, being here and then later being on the other side of an impenetrable barrier. How does it get from one side to the other side of an impenetrable barrier? It doesn't have to get. It can just be here and then later be there. They don't have these paths that we are used to thinking about in terms of like baseballs and rocks and grains of sand.
We see in the second movie an actual quantum tunnel. They make one.
Yes, they do.
First a big one and then one that fits inside a van.
Yeah, they do.
I love that they call it a tunnel. It was such a wink.
And they also went like deep into quantum entanglement and stuff. But you brought up a really interesting point, which is they go down past beyond the atom. And earlier I was arguing for like the plausibility of this PIM particle shrinking people by reducing the inter-atom distance. But that doesn't really work if you want to go smaller than the atom, right?
Yeah.
You can't just do that by bringing atoms closer together, because then the smallest you could be would be like basically, you know, all the size of your atoms stacked together. You couldn't get smaller than the atom or be inside the atom.
I think the densest object we're aware of is a neutron star. Is that accurate, or is there something denser than that?
Neutron stars are extraordinarily dense, right? They're material that's been gravitationally collapsed down to a kind of state that we don't even really understand. It's very, very dense. There might be denser things at the hearts of black holes. We don't know. General relativity tells us that at the very center of a black hole is a thing called a singularity, which is technically infinite density. We don't know if that's real, if it really exists in the universe, or if it's just like, whoa, the theory is broken here and gives you a crazy answer, and you'd be ridiculous to interpret it as reality. We just don't know.
Liesl, this isn't a test, but it's not an easy question either. What is quantum physics?
That seems like one of those things I would not be able to define.
That's a hard question for a particle physicist even.
Yeah, you're up next. Let's say, Liesl, if mom asked you what quantum physics was, how do you think you'd answer her?
I would probably turn to my knowledge of Quantum Leap. Mm-hmm.
That was a documentary, I think.
No, I still don't know.
Daniel, how does a particle physicist define quantum physics?
Yeah, so, you know, what is the job of physics or physicists? The job is to try to find out what are the laws that tell us how to predict the future. Like, you know, in terms of normal physics, you have two tennis balls and you roll them towards each other, and physics will tell you how they will bounce off each other. Oh, they're going to bounce off at this speed and at that angle. Cool. So quantum physics is an attempt to do the same thing, but for quantum particles. It's like, how do you know what's going to happen when you do an experiment at the quantum scale? So you shoot two electrons against each other, or you fire a photon against a double slit. What's going to happen? And on one hand, quantum physics tells you, you just can't know because things aren't determined. There's a randomness. There's a probability for various outcomes. So you do the same experiment multiple times, you get different outcomes, which is kind of mind-boggling. Like you shoot the same electron at the same angle and the same energy, the same apparatus, and you get different outcomes every time, which is kind of crazy. That doesn't mean that you can't predict anything. Quantum physics, instead of predicting the outcome of one individual electron, it tells you, well, I can predict the probability for the electron. So if you do this experiment 1,000 times, here's the set of outcomes you expect to see. So quantum physics is an attempt to sort of like step back and still make predictions about things that can't be predicted. We're making them like statistically over a large number of objects instead of over individual experiments. So quantum physics is our attempt to predict the future of unpredictable things.
I think my biggest struggle in trying to figure these things out is how unintuitive so many of these things are.
Yeah.
I think we understand a lot of science through analogy, mm-hmm. and all of our analogies break at some point. But I think when discussing things at this scale, they break really early in the conversation where you can say it doesn't follow a path from point A to point B, that already our analogies are broken.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just have one question. Who are you? Who is she? What the hell's going on? And can I go back to jail now?
How do you go about like explaining this to somebody with a lay understanding of these?
Yeah, it's tricky. What we try to do is help people develop a new kind of intuition. Like think about why you know how a ball is going to fly through the air if you're playing baseball. You know where to stand to catch it, right? You're not doing some calculation. You're not sitting down with a piece of paper to predict it. Your brain just sort of knows. But how come? It's because you missed the ball a lot of times. You've played catch a lot as a kid. And so your brain sort of figured it out, developed an intuition, a little model inside itself. The problem with quantum physics is that none of that intuition is relevant for what's going on down there because the stuff is just really different from everything we've ever seen before. So people say, for example, oh, it's like a particle. Oh, it's also like a wave. You know, it's not that it's a particle and it's a wave. It's actually neither, right? It's some other weird new thing that sometimes can be described by a particle, sometimes can be described like a wave, sometimes by neither or both. So the way we try to tackle this is get people a new quantum intuition. And that comes just from like walking them through the results of a bunch of weird experiments. Like what happens if you do this? And what happens if you add this device? And what happens if you add this? And if you do that long enough, you do start to develop like an intuition for how things should work at the quantum realm. It's hard though, you know, you have to compete against years and years of intuition at the normal realm of, the, of people with baseballs and tennis balls and stuff. So it's tricky. Sometimes you also just have to follow the math. But for, you know, intro stuff, the quantum mechanical math can be pretty hairy.
A big part of the search for Janet in the quantum realm revolves around the idea that when Scott went down there...
It's quantum entanglement between the quantum states of Posner molecules in your brains.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Liesl, we aren't allowed to play Pictionary or charades on the same team anymore. Do you think it's because our brains became entangled at some point?
We were playing Pictionary and David and I were on the same team, probably one of the last games it was allowed to happen. He drew straight line and then I said pharmacy and yeah, I was right. And I have no idea why I guessed that, but that happens frequently when we play games like that. We're no longer allowed to be on the same team.
You guys aren't twins, are you? You have that special twin code?
No, 5 years apart.
Yeah, this won't make it into the episode, but I had a twin in the womb and I kicked him out very early on in the process. And we one time made the joke that we just think so similarly and we are so similar that maybe Liesl was that twin who'd actually just hung on for 5 years. God.
I was about to say that because that's why I stopped talking and I was like, I can't say that on a podcast. But I don't tell that story without making that joke. So I was like, I don't know where to go from here.
Yeah, the pharmacy incident was an extreme example.
Yeah, but that was peak.
We think very similarly. And so when we play games like that, charades or whatever, we'll make connections a little more quickly.
Yeah, we do like follow the same thought processes a lot of the times.
I wonder if that's true anymore because we haven't lived in the same state for like a decade.
Yeah, maybe we need an experimental Pictionary game.
You guys are like a nature versus nurture experiment in real life.
So, Daniel, what is quantum entanglement? Pictionary and Ant-Man aside.
Quantum entanglement is a super weird property of particles. It happens when two particles are made sort of together and they have to together follow some law of physics. So for example, if you have two electrons and they're made together and they're made with no spin, spin is just some quantum property, then together they have to have no spin. So if one of them has negative spin, the other one would have to have positive spin. So it sort of like adds up and balances the books. So when you make two electrons, you might not know which one has positive spin and which one has negative spin. And in fact, quantum physics tells us it's not actually determined. Like each one has some probability to have positive or negative spin. So that's kind of cool. But there's this rule that they have to have the opposite spin, right? So if the first electron could be positive or negative, the second one could be positive or negative, but it has to be the opposite. So it's sort of constrained to the first one there. Their fates are entangled. And that's really cool because if you measure the spin of the first one and you get plus one, then you automatically know the spin of the other one. But it's not just that you automatically know it, it changes the other one. The other one used to be maybe plus, maybe minus. Now it's definitely minus. And this happens even if the particles are like meters or kilometers or potentially even light years apart.
There are a number of sci-fi novels that use this to communicate across the vast distances their stories take place in instantly. And I think it was Orson Scott Card who coined the word Ansible for this idea. Well, let's say we're at least a ways away from that, because I think right now the explanation of the particles is hard for a lot of folks to follow.
Quantum entanglement cannot allow you to send information faster than the speed of light. I love Ender's Game, and I read a lot of Orson Scott Card before I found out he was not such a nice guy.
Yeah.
But the Ansible is not ever going to be real, because while you can influence a particle faster than the speed of light, like if you make a measurement of one entangled particle, it does affect one at somehow faster than the speed of light. You can't actually use that to transmit information.
Liesl, I have a general question for you. You're a huge Lord of the Rings fan. When you watch a movie that's trying to ground itself in the real world versus one that has things like magic and hobbits and so on, do you watch them differently? Do you differentiate when they make outlandish claims, or is it just about the movie?
I think it depends, like, on the world. Like, are they presenting things in a way that have some kind of realism, or like, are they presenting it like this is the rules of this world? And then, like, do they follow the rules that they set, or do they then like start going off on like crazy things that might annoy me? But I think it depends like on the fantasy world itself, how like particular I might be about it. Like in the Mistborn books, it's not movie, but in the books, like there's a very set system of like rules and magic, and it's almost like a science-based magic system. So I expect them to stay within what they have already established.
Yeah. So like if at the base of Mount Doom, Frodo just strapped on an Iron Man suit and flew up and dropped the ring in, that probably would have...
Yeah, I'd be pretty upset if they messed up Frodo like that.
So let's say J.R.R. Tolkien wrote that in. It probably wouldn't become the classic it did. But even in a system where we don't understand any of those rules, they're magic.
Yeah.
You have to follow your own rules.
Yeah, and Tolkien especially, probably more so than a lot of other authors or creators, had a very specific way that everything tied together, worked together. And Lord of the Rings gives you like a snippet of it. And then when you dig into all his other stuff, it's like he has everything explained. Everything makes sense within the world he created in his own way. And like, so yeah, if I was watching the movie and they did something crazy that didn't fit with what Tolkien originally intended, I'd be pretty upset.
Daniel, I want to read you a quote from Dr. Bill Foster, played by Lawrence Fishburne in Ant-Man and the Wasp. I'd like you to tell us what this means, because I have no idea. he's giving a lecture to some students and says, this is kind of long.
In an isolated system, particles coexist in a stable phase relationship. If the system is interfered with, that stability becomes chaos, unpredictable, dangerous, beautiful. Isolated completely, a quantum system would revert back to separate states of matter, each entangled with a distinct state of its environment. In other words, the object in question would be both in and out of phase with multiple parallel realities.
I got a little lost in that.
There's definitely some real science in there, which is really interesting.
Okay.
And he's talking about a really tricky concept called quantum decoherence and the connection between that and like how particles are measured. The thing about quantum physics that's really weird is this effect that when you measure something, it seems to change it. Like you have particles and they have probabilities to be here or there. Or you can take a famous example, Schrodinger's cat. The cat is in the box and its fate is determined by the reaction of some quantum experiment, you know, a radioactive decay or whatever. And so if you don't know, if you haven't looked inside the box, then the cat has a probability to be alive and a probability to be dead. And this is often described as the cat is both alive and dead. Reality is that the cat has a probability to be alive and a probability to be dead. And its state is actually not determined, right? It's not like it is one and the other. It's just there's a potential there that has the universe hasn't decided yet. The weird thing about quantum mechanics is when you open the box and you interfere with it, the universe says, okay, well, now I have to decide. And it somehow collapses those probabilities to either cat is dead or the cat is alive. And so there's an issue there about isolation. If the cat can be isolated from anybody who's going to be looking at it, it can stay in its state of like quantum weirdness forever. As soon as it interacts with people, as soon as people open the box, then those people require it to collapse. Now, this is like a really weird idea, and we don't really understand it. And, you know, does it have to be a person that collapses it? If there was like an amoeba in the box, could it look at the cat? People have tried to get around this whole tricky philosophical question of like, what makes the universe decide which quantum fate is real by suggesting that maybe they all happen. Like, when you open the box, you just become part of the experiment. And now there's like two universes, one where you opened it and the box has a dead cat, one where you opened it and the box has a live cat. And so like you are now split and you're part of multiple quantum realities. And because you are entangled now with the cat, like you have interacted with it. And so you have some connection with the cat, and these rules we talked about, quantum entanglement, constrain, you know, what you and the cat can together do. And so there's a lot of science in there, but it's also mixed up with, you know, a lot of just sort of like word salad.
It sounds like our perception could be part of the equation, which I find interesting.
Yeah, exactly. We don't understand when the universe decides to roll this dice. And does it matter if it's like us paying attention? Like if you did the experiment, open the box, but you didn't look at the result, would that mean the universe is deciding or not deciding? It's a really tricky question and a really deep problem, actually, at the heart of quantum mechanics, something we really just do not understand. And it also, it's interesting because it's a clue. It tells us like there's something really interesting and weird about the universe that we don't yet understand. So we're probably looking at things the wrong way. And in 100 years, people will look back and sort of like snicker at the naivete of how we tried to answer these questions.
It's my understanding that the Schrodinger's cat thought experiment was a critique of this idea.
Yes, exactly. It's one of the class of ideas where somebody's like, surely you don't believe quantum mechanics because then this would be true. And then people went out and said, actually, you know, that's exactly what we believe. And we think that really happened.
Next up, we have a segment in the show called, technically, you got to imagine like pushing your glasses up there. Lisa and I are going to keep quiet as Daniel gives us some nuance or details or anything related even tangentially to the topic. Daniel, you have the floor.
So we already talked a lot about the science of Ant-Man and whether it's realistic. And I think they did a great job of taking some of the deep questions about quantum mechanics and fusing them into the show in a way that like affected the plot and the choices that people made and constrained them in fascinating ways. The thing that I thought was really impressive about this show that really got me sort of jazzed up was their depiction of the quantum realm. You talked about it earlier, sort of like a 70s black light. But I thought that visually, they did a great job of conveying sort of like the weirdness, the mystery of it. Because, you know, we are a visual species. We like to see things. And it's very difficult for us to talk about what's happening in the microscopic level without making a mental picture. So when I was watching this movie, I was wondering, how are they going to portray the quantum realm? How are they going to, you know, make something up? And I was frankly prepared to be like disappointed and annoyed, but I was really impressed. I thought that what they described just showed sort of the weirdness and the incomprehensibility and the unfathomness, and that we have to sort of bump up against that, that there are parts of the universe that our minds that are used to thinking in this way, at this scale and at this speed, will just always have a hard time understanding. So kudos to the visual artists who I think did a great job of getting sort of the science right.
Okay, Liesl, close us out. What are your final quantum thoughts?
Well, Ant-Man has always been my favorite Avenger. People are like, Ant-Man? Really? But I always liked him when I was a kid when we watched that Avengers cartoon. Ant-Man and the Wasp were my favorite because I think they were so unique and like they explore ideas and concepts that other superheroes never touch on. One of the cool things I think about the movies, as a teacher anyway, is that I bet there's some kids out there that have gotten interested in quantum physics because of a comic book movie. And I think that's pretty awesome. I knew this episode was going to wrinkle my brain a little bit because quantum physics always does that to me. But yeah, this is really interesting. The more realism to the movie than I definitely expected.
certainly more than I gave them credit for. When I started writing the script for this episode, I was like, this is going to be a short one. It's going to be, hey, does any of this work? And Daniel says, no. Okay, thanks for listening.
I know a quantum physicist worked on the show and they got script ideas from things that he told them.
Yeah, they often have science advisors. I think, though, that sometimes they're not looking for, like, is this accurate? They're looking for, like, ideas and concepts which they can then, like, graft onto their script. Because, you know, like the quantum entanglement that happens in the second Ant-Man movie, you know, it's inspired by the concepts of quantum entanglement. And are you in this universe or that parallel universe? But it was pretty far from like anything that could actually happen, even if you were a master of quantum physics 500 years from now. So I think there's a lot of artistic license there. They're looking for like sources of inspiration rather than like, you know, science fact-checking.
Daniel, maybe once Ant-Man 3 Quantum Mania.
I was just going to ask what you think about that title.
Wait, is that real? I thought you were joking.
No, that's real. Ant-Man 3 Quantum Mania.
Well, that's what I think of the title. It sounds like a joke.
There's a couple scenes where they're sort of winking to the camera a little bit, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, that's nice.
I want to be clear, as always, that I love these movies. Scientific accuracy is not a necessary component for good storytelling. In fact, sometimes it gets in the way. I want to thank my guests, Daniel Whiteson and Liesl Reinersman, for being on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and cross your fingers, there's an episode 8. That's all for this episode. Thanks once again to my guests, Daniel Whiteson and Liesl Reinersman. Their willingness to dive into this weird and challenging topic means a lot to me. MCU audio clips were taken from Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp, and all used entirely without permission. Please don't sue me. The music is a song called On Tiptoe from Purple Planet Music. That song and more royalty-free music can be found at purple-planet.com. And not to brag, but just to clarify for the sake of the credits, all other aspects of the production, including research, writing, and editing, were done by me, Dave Reinersman. Thanks for listening!
Quantum realm.
Quantum entanglement.
Quantum energy.
Quantum phasor.
Quantum spectrometer.
Quantum system.
Quantum state.
Quantum research.
Quantum anomaly.
Quantum void.
Quantum tunnel.
Quantum technology.
Quantum healing particles.
Do you guys just put the word quantum in front of everything?